If you talk to anyone in automotive engineering, I mean, really get them talking, they'll eventually complain about the lightweighting paradox.
Oh, yeah. It's the fundamental conflict, right? The core headache of the job.
It is. Because on one hand, you've got fuel economy, emissions targets, performance, all that just screams, make it lighter.
You want a featherweight chassis.
Exactly. But on the other side of that same equation, you have safety regulations.
Which scream, make it a tank.
Make it a tank. You need that passenger cabin to be an impenetrable fortress. But here's the problem. Traditionally, materials that are super, super strong, they're brittle.
They snap like glass. Think diamond.
Right. And then materials that can absorb energy, the ones that bend and deform, they're just too soft. They won't stop an intrusion.
You usually can't have both. If you increase strength, you almost always sacrifice ductility. That's the ability to stretch. And for a car crash, you need both.
So engineers are always trying to find a cheat code for this rule. And today we're doing a deep dive into a PhD thesis that, well, it claims to have found a pretty spectacular one.
We're looking at the work of Hongliang Yi from the Graduate Institute of Ferris Technology. It's a dense piece of work, but the implications are just huge.
The topic is a material called dotrip steel. That's delta trip. And the promise here is a steel that's rust-proof, easy to weld, and somehow manages to be both incredibly strong and incredibly stretchy.
It's essentially a roadmap for building that crash-proof car. And it does it using a microstructure that looks like a tiny microscopic forest.
Okay, we're definitely going to get to the trees in a minute, but first let's break down the TRIP part of that name. It stands for transformation-induced plasticity.
Right.
I've read the definition, but what does that actually mean in, you know, a physical sense?
Think of it this way. Most materials are static. You build something out of steel, its crystal structure is set. It is what it is.
It resists until it fails.
Exactly. Trippy steel is dynamic. It's designed to change its internal structure while it's being deformed.
So it actually reacts to the crash.
Precisely. It relies on a specific phase of iron called retained austenite. Now, normally, austenite is only stable at very high temperatures.
Like when the steel is glowing orange.
Right. At room temperature, steel wants to be ferrite. But in trip steel, we use chemistry to trap little pockets of this austenite at room temperature. It's metastable. It's just
waiting.
Waiting for a trigger.
Yes. And the trigger is mechanical force. When the car hits something and that steel starts to bend, the stress forces the soft austenite to instantly snap into a different phase.
Martensite.
The hardest, strongest form of steel. So it's like an airbag, but instead of a bag of air deploying, the metal itself hardens right where the stress is highest. It literally absorbs the crash energy to fuel its own transformation.
That's incredible. So it's using the energy of the crash to upgrade itself on the fly.
That's a perfect way to put it. That's the plasticity.
Okay, so trip steel sounds like actual magic. Why isn't every single car made of this stuff already? What's the catch? The catch is chemistry. Specifically, the chemistry you need to keep that austenite around at room temperature.
Okay.
To stop the austenite from disappearing, you have to stop carbon from leaking out and forming something called cementite iron carbide. If cementite forms, your austenite dies.
They need a stabilizer.
And traditionally, the industry uses silicon, a lot of it, about 1.5% by weight. Silicon is great at suppressing cementite. It's like a bodyguard for the carbon.
Right.
But silicon completely ruins the manufacturing process, specifically rust proofing.
This is the galvanizing issue, right?
Exactly. Modern cars are hot dip galvanized. We run the steel sheet through a bath of molten zinc.
Stopped it from rusting.
The problem is that silicon and zinc are enemies. When steel with that much silicon goes into the furnace, the silicon rushes to the surface and reacts with oxygen. It forms a thin layer of, well, basically glass, silicon dioxide.
And I'm guessing zinc doesn't stick to glass.
Slides right off. You get these bare spots. They call them tiger stripes. So you end up with a super safe car that rusts out in 2 years.
A total deal breaker.
Complete deal breaker. And this is where Hongliang Yi's work comes in. His thesis is an attempt to solve this silicon problem.
And his solution?
Swap the silicon for aluminum.
Aluminum, like from a soda can?
It sounds simple, but aluminum is unique here. It does the same job as silicon. It suppresses cementite, but it plays nice with the zinc. You can galvanize high aluminum steel perfectly.
So just fine and replace. Silicon out, aluminum in. Why is that a PhD level problem?
Because when you add that much aluminum, we're talking over 2% by weight, you fundamentally change the thermodynamics of the steel. You change how it freezes. And that leads us to the delta entry trick.
The delta ferrite.
Right. When liquid steel cools, crystals grow. In this specific recipe, the first thing to grow is deferrite, and it grows in this very specific tree-like shape.
Ye calls them dendrites.
Yes. Think of frost on a window pane. That's a dendritic structure. These long branching arms of ferrite growing through the liquid metal.
Now, usually in steel, isn't deferrite just temporary? It shows up when it's super hot and then disappears as it cools.
In almost all carbon steels, yes, it's a ghost. But here's the trick. Aluminum is a ferrite stabilizer. With so much aluminum in the mix, that deferrite becomes stable. It doesn't disappear. It survives all the way down to room temperature.
So the final steel has these microscopic trees of ferrite embedded in it.
Yeah.
Forever.
Exactly. It's a composite structure. You have the skeleton of the ferrite trees, and in the spaces between the branches, that's where the carbon gets concentrated, and that's where your retained austenite lives.
So the trees protect the magic airbag material.
They do. And the results are, well, they're staggering. Yai's data shows this material hitting a tensile strength of 1,000 megapascals.
That's 1 gigapascal. That's serious high-strength territory.
It is, but the elongation and the stretch is 23%.
Okay, put that in context. For a normal 1 gigapascal steel, what kind of stretch are you getting?
Maybe 5%. If you're lucky, 10. To get 23% at that strength level is, it's the holy grail. It means the metal can absorb a massive amount of energy before it snaps.
But reading the thesis, it sounds like actually getting those trees to grow properly is a bit of a nightmare. There's that chapter, The Vagaries of Solidification.
Which is a great title. It sounds like a fantasy novel.
It does. But it's really about this fight between computer models and reality.
Right. You used a thermodynamic modeling software, MTData. You punched in the recipe and the computer said, okay, at equilibrium, you should get X amount of ferrite.
But the computer was wrong.
The computer wasn't wrong. It was just optimistic. It assumes equilibrium, meaning the atoms have infinite time to settle. But real-world casting is violent and fast. It's non-equilibrium.
Well, it's musical chairs and the music stopped too soon.
Perfect analogy. The atoms get trapped. Yi tested 3 alloys. Alloy 0 had lower aluminum. And the deferrite just didn't survive. It decomposed.
Into something useless.
Into perlite. Dead weight. So he had to crank up the aluminum. Alloy 2, with about 2.4% aluminum, that was the sweet spot.
So you have to basically overdose the steel with aluminum to force the structure to survive the chaos of cooling.
You have to overwhelm the thermodynamics. You're forcing it into a shape it doesn't want to hold, because that shape saves lives.
Speaking of which, we have to talk about putting the car together. Because you can have the strongest metal in the world, but if you can't weld it,
it's useless. And this is usually where high-strength steels fall apart.
And looking at this recipe, a mechanic would be worried. This steel has 0.4% carbon. That is really high for sheet metal.
It is. The rule of thumb is high carbon plus spot welding equals disaster.
Why? What happens in the weld?
Spot welding is brutal. You pinch the metal sheets, blast them with current, it melts a tiny spot instantly, and then cools just as fast.
A quench.
It's a perfect quench. And when you quench high carbon steel, you get martensite. But not the useful kind. You get untempered, brittle martensite. It's basically glass.
So the weld is just a button of glass. You hit a bump, it snaps.
That's what should happen.
Right.
But you found that the J-trip steel welds beautifully.
How does it cheat the carbon rule?
It's the trees again, the deferrite. Remember, it's stabilized by aluminum. It has a very high melting point. So even in the heat-affected zone right next to the weld, the ferrite dendrites, they don't melt.
They just sit there through the heat.
They persist. So instead of the weld zone turning into a solid block of brittle martensite, you get a mixture. You have the hard martensite, sure, but it's threaded through with these soft, ductile ferrite trees.
It's like a natural rebar in concrete.
Or a shock absorber. If a crack starts in the brittle part, it immediately hits a soft ferrite tree and stops. The energy dissipates.
That is just incredibly convenient. The same structure that gives the steel its ductility also solves its biggest manufacturing problem.
It's a multitasking microstructure. It solves galvanizing, strength, and welding all in one go.
I want to go back to the mechanics of that transformation, the airbag deploying. The thesis gets into a really deep debate about how it happens. Stress versus strain.
Yes. This is one of those things that sounds academic, but is actually critical.
To me, stress and strain are just things I feel on a Monday morning.
Huh. In physics, they're distinct. Stress is the force you apply. Strain is the actual deformation, the change in shape. The question is, does the crystal transform because you bent it or because the pressure makes it want to?
And the verdict.
Yi argues for stress-assisted transformation, and he points to this fascinating phenomenon called mechanical stabilization.
This is the part where the crystal can get jammed, right?
Exactly. Imagine the austenite crystal is a room. If you deform it, the strain you're throwing furniture around inside, you're creating defects, dislocations.
Debris.
It's debris. And if you create too much of that debris before the transformation happens, the crystal gets physically stuck. It can't change shape into martensite.
So if you bend it too much at the wrong time, you actually stop the airbag from working.
You kill the effect. You stabilize the austenite too much. That's why you argue stress is the driver. You need that thermodynamic push.
Which means you have to tune this material so carefully. You need the transformation to happen in that Goldilocks zone.
Not too early, not too late.
There's one more layer here I found amazing. Hydrostatic pressure.
Yes, that's a key piece. These grains of austenite, they're not floating in space. They're trapped, surrounded by hard bainite in those ferrite trees.
And the surroundings are squeezing them.
Constantly. As the steel cools, everything around the austenite contracts and puts it under immense pressure. Yi found that thin films of austenite were much more stable than big, blocky chunks.
Because they're being squeezed tighter?
Correct. The pressure holds them in that metastable state right up until the crash.
It really paints a picture of this steel not as a solid block, but as a stored energy device. It's like a loaded spring at the atomic level.
That's a perfect analogy. It's potential energy waiting to become kinetic protection.
So let's zoom out. We've got D-trip steel. It works in the lab. It solves the rust problem. It welds. Where does this go next?
Well, the thesis ends on a very optimistic note. Yi suggests we haven't even hit the ceiling. He talks about the potential for extraordinary ductility.
Even more than 23%.
He believes so. He suggests that if we can refine the processing, how we roll and heat treat the steel, we could potentially align those dendrites.
Like combing hair.
In a way, yes. If you control the orientation of the trees, you control how stress flows through the material even better. We could be looking at steels that have the formability of soft aluminum, but the strength of armor plate.
The dream of a gum that holds like a tank?
It feels within reach. And what's amazing is that this isn't using some rare earth element or some sci-fi nanotech. It's iron, aluminum, carbon, the same stuff we've used for a century. We're just arranging the atoms differently.
It's incredible to think we are still finding new secrets in something as old as steel.
Metallurgy is far from a solved science. There's always another microstructure to discover.
So the next time you get into your car, maybe you look at that A-pillar next to the windshield. It just looks like a piece of painted metal.
But underneath that paint, there's a massive chemical balancing act going on.
A forest of microscopic trees, a battle between aluminum and silicon, and a bunch of pressurized crystals just waiting to save your life.
And thanks to the aluminum, hopefully no rust.
Exactly. That is the paradox of D-trip steel. Thanks for listening to this deep dive. Stay curious, and we'll see you in the next one.